Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Feature, and we're going to be talking about bird migration. This is the second of a series of programs with Dr. Gordon Adkins. Dr. Gordon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're really excited about this. What we'll be talking about is a series of spring and fall migrations, and this is a second of that particular series. Dr. Gordon Adkins has a doctorate in neuroscience of animals, and he's here at Camp Asabo, and we're recording at Camp Asabo. We may not always do it here, but we're doing this edition here, and he's also called the Nature Guy. So welcome back, and we're excited about today's program. What are we going to be talking about today?
Well, today our topic is about the spring waterfowl migration. It's the first real migration in the spring dominated by the ducks and geese and swans.
Very good. Let's start with a word of prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, as we look deeper and closer, we can see your hand, your marvelous hand, the depth and the intricacies, and it just makes us want to praise you more. Lord, be with Dr. Adkins and I as we explore the subject of migration, and be with our listeners as they learn and appreciate what you've done and where maybe apply it and find something in their own backyard or nearby and can identify with migration to a new level. In Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Adkins, what do we mean by waterfowl?
Well, waterfowl is a sort of a general term that includes a group of fairly large birds as they go. These are all the species of ducks, geese, and swans.
Very good. Now, what's happening this month in March in the migration?
Well, this is the peak of the waterfowl migration. It may actually, in the lower part of the state, be starting in February, depending on how the winters go. This year's been kind of a strange year. Not as many birds have gone as far south because we haven't had as much freeze over. They need open water, but regardless, there are birds that have gone further south that'll be passing by. And March is the peak.
So how do you determine your information? Is it by observation, or do you also consult other, is that heard on the street of the biologist?
Well, migration's been studied for a long time, of course. And in studies of animal behavior, we've learned a lot. And ducks have really been, especially for the early explorations, they were an important group of birds that were studied because they're big and strong. They're very powerful flyers. And so before the miniaturization of electronics that we have today, these kind of bulky battery packs and transmitters and so forth were significant. And really it was only a duck or a goose that could carry it. So we did learn a lot that way. And, we'll talk about how we are doing it now in another session when we get into the specifics of the miniaturization of electronics. So we learned a lot in general, but there are also, you know, birders keep track of when things come and go. And there is an electronic database called eBird, not eBay, but eBird, where birders report all of their sightings by day, by location, and even number of each species.
So I have a couple questions. How long has eBird been in the public domain?
It's been going for about 10 years, but it also has a feature where birders can provide information that they've had in a shoebox somewhere in their list or their logbook. And so historical data is being added into it back even 100 years.
So data is growing exponentially.
Absolutely.
Or at least becoming which was isolated. You said shoebox, and maybe different departments of of universities and different groups may have had this data, and now it's being uploaded and aggregated.
Correct. So all these loose pieces are now coming into one central location. And what they've been able to do now, we'll talk maybe another session a lot more about eBird, but you can actually, you can follow migration, pick a species and follow it on eBird, or even get counts of the number of birds that went overhead last night.
Let's even go to, you mentioned about these bird packs in the early primitive states. When was an idea, how many decades or years have we, what was the first when we started to get some information based on remote transponders from ducks?
Well, it was really after radar developed in World War II.
Okay.
And that technology developed, that it then began to be applied in biological situations, first with large mammals, but then later with birds. And basically it was a battery-powered transmitter that sent out a beep or a couple of beeps. And then the receiver could then, based on the angle of the antenna and how it was being held, this process we call telemetry, basically figure out which direction that beep came from. And the louder the beep, the closer you were. And you kind of, it was a very sort of searching in the dark kind of thing, but you could follow things if you could keep up. Of course, a flying bird, that was a lot harder to keep up. And that only really started more in the 60s, I think, when we were able to get stronger transmitters so that if it got away from you 20 or 30 miles, you could still catch up. The original ones, if you were out of 2 mile range, you lost it.
And so probably you said after World War II, so that's the late 40s and early 50s. And then in the 60s, the signals and the equipment got stronger and so on and so forth.
Yeah, the transistor, when that became readily available in circuitry, that just allowed us to make things smaller and stronger, and we were able to do more work at a distance. And some of these birds are migrating long distances, so that was really essential.
So where are these birds going to, and where have they come from?
So there's a lot of different species of waterfowl, so the answer to that is quite varied. But generally, the birds have migrated from their breeding grounds in the tundra. We talked about that in the last episode with the snowy owl. So they're up there breeding in the same location. But obviously,
they're doing that in the summer.
In the summer. And so they've had to have flown south to get to some open water and a food source. South could be Michigan, because our Great Lakes seldom freeze over. So we do have some ducks that stay here. A lot of other ducks fly further south, and many of the duck species that nest in the tundra will overwinter in South America. So now in the spring, they're coming back from those locations. And so the ducks that maybe didn't go as far are some of the first ones to start heading back. And the ones that went way down south, it'll take a while before they get caught up to Michigan and then pass through here overhead.
So how fast do ducks fly?
Roughly between 40 and 60 miles an hour, and right in the middle of that, most ducks fly at 50 miles an hour. When there's a tailwind, they can make a little more progress. And when they're chased, they can get up to 60. I think the fastest that I'm aware of is 69 miles an hour when it has to.
So when they're doing this migration, do they fly straight through, or do they take rest breaks?
Well, they do long distance flying, but the ones that really are traveling quite a distance have to break it up, because flight for a heavy duck just involves a lot of energy. If you pay attention when they're flying over, those wings are beating really fast, and that takes energy. So they have to have a store of energy, which is usually fat stored in the breast tissue. And then they'll fly till they kind of run out of energy and they've got to stop. And ducks, being that they fly in flocks, or waterfowl in general, not just ducks, they they have sort of traditional stopover spots. They're flying in flocks. They kind of they do a lot of communicating. You hear that when a flock of Canada geese goes over. They're communicating about what they're doing. Should we stop here? No, let's keep going. They're working as a group, making decisions of where to go and where to stop. So there are traditional stopover points and traditional overwintering spots. Some are very specific, and others seem to be more general depending on the weather and other conditions.
What about the distance that they fly, or even the time of day? How many hours are they on wing, and how many hours are they feeding, and how many hours would they be doing some other activity?
So they'll fly quite a distance and maybe even fly all day and all night in one of those ventures, and then they'll pause for probably several days, even a week or two, to build up the fat reserves, depending on how much food is available where they've stopped. But the record, a lot of the studies have been done with mallards. They're one of the most widespread ducks, and so one mallard that we know of traveled 800 miles in 24 hours. So a single flight, 24 hours long, 800 miles.
Driving straight through.
Well, that's not straight through, but that's a good long leg, and then a stop. And so they may do two or three of these big blocks of travel with time in between to rest and find food. And they do a lot of maintenance on their feathers too. Flying that long is tough on the feathers, and they have to make sure that they're, all the Velcro is zipped together. It's kind of like that. And that they also have an oil gland that they have to waterproof their feathers. That's particularly important if they run into bad weather. It's tough on feathers. But the record we have is a northern pintail, and it traveled 1,800 miles, a little over 1,800 miles in a single flight. So they are capable of traveling long distance.
I'm glad you brought out that just because I don't fly. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought about the feathers and the feather maintenance that, if you're driving a long trip, tires wear and different things break down. And
oil change, wiper blades, all those things do wear out, and that's the same thing for the duck.
What about how high do birds fly?
There's quite a range, but most duck migration, waterfowl migration, is at about 200 to 4,000 feet. In fact, a lot of birds migrate in that range. But there is a record, an unfortunate record for the duck. A duck hit an airliner at 21,000 feet. And there are species of waterfowl that migrate over the Himalayas. And so it's uncommon to be that high up, but they're capable of flying very high.
Do birds fly higher when they're migrating than when they're in their resting areas of breeding or feeding?
Yes, so they're moving from one feeding area to another, or to an overnight roosting spot. That's just, high enough to get over the trees and whatever. But when they're heading off, depending on the winds, of course, and air pressure changes, they're usually higher aloft than just overhead.
Is there less resistance the higher you go, minus the weather systems?
That's complicated.
Okay.
because air pressure relates to lift, but then also to drag and turbulence, and it's the whole aerodynamics of flight is very complicated, and maybe we'll spend some time talking about that in another episode, but it's complicated. There's not a simple answer.
Well, I'm glad that there's some depth to that. We talked about weather and it affecting migration. Anything else that we should touch on at this point?
Well, when we think of the weather, we can't kind of think of the rain and the snow. But wind can be an important factor, and maybe even more so. Obviously, if it's heavy, heavy snow or heavy, heavy rain, that's going to add weight to the feathers, make flying more difficult, adds friction and so forth. But even in the absence of rain or snow, the wind is really an issue because, this is an aerodynamic organism flying through the air. And if there's a 45 mile an hour crosswind, that's going to change everything. And it can, storms can cause birds to get off track. They can be blown off track because of that. And then depending on their mechanism of navigation, it may be hard for them to find their way back. So a lot of birds will avoid flying in windy, turbulent weather because that can mess up, play games with their navigation.
Very good. Well, listeners, you're listening to Strong Tower Radio Feature. We're talking with Dr. Atkins, and we're talking about the spring migration. It's part of a series of migration, which is both spring and fall. We're really looking forward to the whole series. We are learning so much. Dr. Atkins, you talked about weather and rain. We can apply this to when we're flying in planes. They'd rather go around a big thunderhead than go through it. Do birds have the same preferences?
Yes, and they make corrections. So, again, depending on the type of navigation that they use, some have no problem figuring out, okay, if I go 50 miles west and then north and around back, I'll get to the same spot as if I flew straight through. Birds will avoid it if they can. If they get stuck with it, they can go around. And when the wind's blowing, many of the birds are able to detect that wind speed and then adjust their angle of attack so that they are capable still of flying to their destination without getting blown off. Obviously, the bigger bird, like the ducks and geese, the waterfowl, they're going to do a better job of that than, say, a little, you know, 1 ounce warbler.
Let's talk about ducks, diving ducks and those who feed on the surface.
Yeah, so ducks are generally divided into two categories based on their feeding style. We have the dabbler ducks, which are the ones on the surface, like a mallard or a black duck. It looks like they're nibbling at the surface of the water or just under the water. And their bills are constructed with basically a little strainer on the edge. And the edge of a bill of a duck is as sensitive as your fingertips.
Even though it's hard cartilage or something?
It's hard. There's a skin over top and there are nerve endings there. So snapping down on some water, and whatever's in the water will like to squirt out through the side. They almost look like little teeth on the side, but they're not teeth, little jagged edge. And so as they're, you know, opening and closing their mouths rapidly, that is creating this filtration, and the bill is so sensitive it can feel those little particles and then swallow when necessary.
So how many times would they open and close those bills?
They can open and close the bill 4 or 5 times a second. So it's a very,
very rapid.
Very rapid. You see the ripples in the water spreading out more than you can actually follow the bill itself when you're looking closely.
So you have the dabblers, and then you have that other category, which is diving ducks?
The diving ducks, or often referred to as bay ducks. These are ducks that will, their food is out of reach. If they just kind of bob their head down, and you sometimes see that with dabblers, their rear end's up in the air and their head's down the water, but they can only reach that distance. If the food source is further than that, then the diving ducks or the bay ducks will dive down sometimes quite a distance, 30, 40, 50 feet, to find the food source at the bottom of the body of water that they're at, and then come to the surface to eat it.
Are they looking for different food?
Yes and no. Some of the diving ducks are looking for vegetation and small things like a dabbling duck would, but a lot of the other diving ducks are actually going after mollusks. So clams, if there's a clam bed nearby, they'll focus and drop down on those.
So does any of those birds eat snails?
Yes. So snails are a type of mollusk, and if they can reach them, if it's small enough, they'll just swallow it whole.
So when do waterfowl migrate?
Well, kind of depends on which of the waterfowl species. So most geese and swans migrate during the day. And of course, like all wild animals, early morning and late evening are highlight parts of the day. But the ducks, while they can migrate during the day and often do, the nighttime seems to be the preferred time of day to migrate. One theory is there are fewer predators around at night that can follow them and so forth. But if you're flying at night, you, of course, have to have a way of finding your way. And there are different ways that they do that. We don't have time to get into them now, but in other episodes, we plan to talk about the various mechanisms of navigation that birds can use when they're flying at night.
So let's talk about the early ducks and the later ducks in the migration.
Right. So as I mentioned, some haven't gone that far south, and they're the first ones to come back. And it's almost like they're kind of monitoring the freeze line. As soon as there's open water, they seem to know to be there, and they just work their way up. And so things like buffalo heads, little small black and white ducks with an iridescent head, they're one of the diving ducks. So you see them disappear, and then they pop back up. They're here. I've often seen them even diving down under the edge of the ice of the partially frozen lake and coming back up in an open spot. Mergansers, there's three species of mergansers that come through Michigan, and they seem to be one of the very first to come if there's open water. And we've kept track here at Camp Asaba of the birds, of course, what birds are here and when they first arrive in the spring. And almost without fail, March 1, the common mergansers show up on our lake. Even if all there is just a little corner of the lake where the springs are, where there isn't any ice, I can almost know when March starts by just watching for the mergansers. So there was one year they came a little early and one year they came a little late, but March 1 is our average.
The old faithful of the ducks.
At least for the early migrants, they're the ones that I can be sure of.
Well, give our listeners an idea. You mentioned something before the program that the spring migration has advantages because the colors are more distinct. You can identify the birds easier.
Yes. So they're in their breeding plumage. Many birds change colors. They go through a molt where they lose their feathers, not all at once, of course, but one by one they get lost and one by one they get replaced. So in the spring migration, these birds almost always have acquired their spring plumage, their breeding plumage, which is the most colorful and the most distinct.
So you're going to be more accurate in the spring than the fall?
It's easier to figure out who's who, especially if they're just flying by. But yeah, if it's got a solid green head, it's a mallard, and it's pretty obvious. You can't get that one mixed up.
And the buffalo head is black and with white.
Black and white. Now, unfortunately, there's a lot of black and white ducks, so that can get challenging, but where the black and white is, where the iridescence is.
What about our mergansers? What would be identifying for them?
Now, mergansers are interesting, and they often get misidentified as loons because they have that posture of a loon, sort of low in the water, hold their bill straight out ahead, and they've got a fairly long, skinny bill because, like loons, their main food is fish. So they like to catch minnows. The thing about the loon just has a normal, straight bill, very stout and strong. The mergansers have these little teeth-like structures on the edge, and they're exaggerated in a merganser compared to all the other ducks. So they got a real grippy other upper bill. So if they're catching a squirming minnow, they got a way of holding on to it. But that requires you get a close-up look.
That's true. So other early ducks?
So we also have the swans, the trumpeter swans. They come through. And we probably ought to have a session just about trumpeter swans sometimes.
Let's
because
do it.
They were critically endangered and then reintroduced back into Michigan up in the Upper Peninsula as a breeding ground. And now they are relatively plentiful. I mean, we still have to be careful with them, but they're doing very, very well. And they're one of those waterfowl that'll just kind of follow the freezing and thawing of the water systems, and they don't travel very far south, and then they'll be kind of one of the first ones back. Of course, Canada geese can come early, and some varieties come late. So they're kind of throughout the whole the whole spectrum, but they can be some of the earliest ones too.
And you can't misidentify them.
If you've heard them or seen them in your yard, you know what we're talking about.
And then do we have the canvasbacks?
Yes, a canvasback, that's going to be one of the species you tend to see out in the open water in the Great Lakes. They also hang around the ice edge and don't go too far. There's lots of others we could talk about, but those can accumulate in fairly large numbers in Michigan and come through early.
What about our later ducks?
Yeah, so there's not a good distinction between earlier and later, but there are those that seem to lag behind and come up after the ice has completely gone off the waterways. If they're relying on a lot of insect life, the water's going to have to warm up a bit. And if they're not plant-oriented or fish-oriented, they're kind of coming up later when the vegetation has grown enough to support insects. And some of those, interestingly, are some of our smaller ducks as well. So like the blue-winged and the green-winged teal. Teal are a small group of ducks. Colorful wings, as the name implies. They're going to be some of the ones that come later. And wood ducks are interesting because they tend to stay in Michigan. They don't pass by. They migrate back up to Michigan, and this is their nesting spot. So probably mallards and Canada geese and wood ducks are our main nesting waterfowl that won't pass. Some pass by and go further north, but many can just land up here and stay and breed.
Let's talk about, we wanted to make it practical as for this program, and we want people to go out and observe these migrating groups. Give us the best places to go look in March.
Sure. So with the duck migration in March, at peaking in March, the shorelines of the Great Lakes. Now, that's a big area. But what that means, if you can get anywhere near the Great Lakes, get in any of the sheltered areas and watch. There'll be waterfowl.
What is a sheltered area?
Well, like a little bay or an edge.
Just off the lake, yeah, you know, like Saugatuck, the Kalamazoo
those
River.
Bays, yes, those would be good things. But even right on, you know, watching from the dunes right out at the shoreline, you will see flocks of ducks going up and down. Some may be resting and feeding in the water in front of you. So that's a lot of Michigan is near the Great Lakes, but also the rivers. Any of the bigger open rivers are good locations to find things, especially the rivers.
Because there's not ice on them.
Right. Rivers near the lake, sort of that fresh water coming into lake. So those bays and rivers that feed into the Great Lakes are good as well. A very artificial location, but actually the best location, is the Muskegon County Wastewater Facility.
Which sounds like yuck.
It's not the nicest smelling place in the world. But
if you want to see birds.
Of all the nutrients in the water, it provides a lot of food. And so they have huge, like thousands of some species all mixed in there together. It's actually quite a challenge to go through and find them all and figure out who's who. But it's a fun place to visit. And then, of course, with the geese, any flooded farm field is a spot for geese. And if you're in the thumb of Michigan, then the tundra swans seem to gather there in the flooded field.
I'll be looking forward. Maybe I'll have to make a special trip that way. Dr. Adkins, thank you for this series. We're learning with each episode, and we're looking forward to fully understanding more than just butterflies and Canada geese. You've been listening to Strong Tower Radio Features, our migration programming. Stay tuned till the next episode. I'm your host, Tom Azure. For Dr. Adkins, God bless. Bye now.